All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, talking to you from the Borough of Queens in New York City, as usual. This is the 29th of March, 2022. Do you like to remind you, I write a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. You can sign up for that by going to miningstocks.com, miningstocks.com. Chen Lin publishes a letter that I read all the time and think is very, very worth its price. It's called What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? ChenPicks.com is the place to go to sign up for that. Chen is a frequent guest on this show, maybe on again very soon. And today we have Michael Oliver, and whenever he's with us, I like to remind people that his website is OliverMSA.com, OliverMSA.com, to sign up for his very important Momentum and Structural Analysis letter, one that I think you don't want to be without if you're a serious investor. I do want to thank all of you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel, and encourage you to send along whatever comments you have about our show to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. I also want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Today's sponsors, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, El Oro Resources, Hand and Metals, Firefox Gold, Timberline Resources, Lion One Metals, and SK Mining. I've titled today's show, The Dollar Approaches Its Threshold of Lethality. Alistair MacLeod, Michael Oliver, and Patrick Highsmith are today's guests. Alistair has recently pointed out that the Fed, the Bank of England, and the Bank of Japan are now themselves becoming insolvent. As interest rates rise along with surging inflation, the massive debt they purchased to stimulate their economies is declining in value, resulting in the balance sheets of those central banks themselves displaying positions of negative net worth accounts. Insolvent central bank balance sheets began to emerge before Russia invaded Ukraine. Now massive sanctions against Russia, keeping it from trading in dollars at a time when supply chain constraints may be much greater even than those created by COVID, that threatens massive shortages of essential commodities on the global markets, which in turn threatens prospects of dramatically higher inflation and a temptation on the part of central banks to print more and more faster and faster in an effort to suppress rising interest rates. That is certainly the kind of policy that can usher in hyperinflation and an increasingly worthless currency. President Biden talks of a new world order with the U.S. leading it, but that may not be possible because creditor countries like China, not debtor countries like the United States, end up owning the world's reserve currency. The hubris of American financial and political leaders seem totally oblivious to the pathology of their massive indebtedness. But their arrogance won't change the laws of economics. Because America has chosen not to run, or because it has chosen to run, not to run trade surpluses, but rather to consume today with little regard for future generations, the U.S. borrowed trillions of dollars to build a superior military. And by driving interest rates down and handing out credit cards like candy to middle and lower income groups, America has basically shot its wad, and now the time has come, I'm afraid, that the piper must be paid. But for those of us who have not bought into the deceitful policies of our ruling elite, we knew a day of reckoning would arrive sometime in the future. Eventually, countries like families can't live beyond their means forever. Corporations got rich by offshoring jobs to developing low-wage countries, the largest of which is now a primary adversary of the United States. And now that country's primary ally, Russia, is playing the same nasty game the United States has played by demanding their oil that they sell be paid for in their own currency. And like the U.S., it is using its military to try to enforce that policy. The current problem in the U.S. is, of course, exacerbated by snowflake Marxist indoctrinated recent college grads who are seeking to shut down the West's own ability to produce the lifeblood of modern society, namely oil and gas, as well as nuclear energy. Alistair will be with me in the second half of today's show to explain why attempts at resetting one kind of fiat currency system for another fiat currency system, and even why Bitcoin and other fiat currencies cannot replace actual money, which is limited to gold and silver, are therefore likely to fail in their efforts to make currency changes and currency resets. Owners of gold in the ground, like Timberline Resources, which appears to be on their way to making a significant Carlin-style high-grade gold discovery in Nevada, should be in a much stronger position than those who have put their faith in our counterfeit dollar. And Patrick Highsmith will be with me to explain Timberline's exciting Eureka gold discovery in Nevada. He'll be with me right after our first commercial break, but right now I'm happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is here. Once again, thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
It's good to have you. Now, I have to ask you, this equity market, it never goes down, Michael. We have, we're still in a bull market in equities, huh? Looks like it. Yeah. I was listening at lunchtime today. There were guys saying, yeah, it's time to jump back in there now on Fox Business.
Our work argues that you've likely seen the top, and that would be late last year. Then you started down, and then we had the war event. I've been in the markets for but roughly half a century, and so as a young kid growing up and watching the action. And whenever people enter a trade, especially late in the trend, and try to go based on war events, pop up occasionally, they're usually wrong. It backfires on them. It sucks in the wrong kind of investor at the wrong time. So what we had, unfortunately, for the bear side of the stock market was, by the time we got into late February, we had the events in Ukraine starting to unfold 5 weeks ago. At that point, the stock market made a low, and then it repeated that low in early March, and then turned up. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's when gold also made a high. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that surge in gold that we had into early March, late February, early March, which was fully technically justified. In fact, back in November, our works said that we're coming out of the congestion, we're going to go back up. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, we were starting back up, and then the war event occurred, and what happened? You had late comers probably putting on initial positions at very high levels based on one assumption, war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, like it's going to continue forever or whatever, all kind of implications. Mm-hmm. Well, and they did the same thing in oil and a few other markets, and they're going to pay for it. Well, they did pay for it. Gold dropped $150 from its high in early March down to a low a week or so ago, then rallied about 60, 70, then came down today and broke through that low. So flushed it out by $10, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Silver did the same type of thing. It made lows in the about 24.50s a couple weeks ago, rallied back up, and came down today and got to just above 24 for several hours. Now it's back up, pushing at 25 again, by the way. I think that the sell-off that we've had in gold and silver since early in March is largely a flush out of latecomers who are buying gold for the wrong reason, who bought gold for the wrong reason. And if they did, and if they were sensitive and they leveraged especially, they're out. They've been flushed. Today's action certainly helped do that. And once we flush them, then I think we go back to normality again, meaning the larger fundamental and technical issues that are driving gold reassert themselves. Now, what's another interesting observation, if I think that's a correct assumption on my part, is that the stock market has done precisely the opposite. So all those folks who are looking at GDX, the gold miners, and they're looking at the stock market, thinking, if the stock market goes down, GDX will go down. It didn't. It went up. It peaked almost the same day that S&P made its low, March the 8th, low close for the S&P. GDX made a high. And the S&P's had a nice rally, and GDX has had a not such a deep pullback at all, more of a congestion zone. In fact, today we're back above 38 again. We're less than a point from the high close of the entire surge we've seen. So that's another lesson, okay? Forget this assumption that the stock market enters a bear trend, that the gold miners are going to follow. And they're not. Okay. War events suck in bad money, and I think we just flushed them. And I think what we're doing in the stock market is those who sold short the stock market in late February, early March, some, you know, way 500, 600 points off the high that occurred late last year, were latecomers, and they've been flushed out the other way with the rally in the S&P. Our short-term work suggests that you might be seeing the rally high in the S&P today or tomorrow, and likely you saw the pullback low in gold and silver today. We haven't got the full upturn yet on the short-term stuff, but it looks that way to us. So, but again, they're opposites. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. And I think going forward, if the S&P, for example, after this teasing rally, which if you look at a price chart, no doubt has sucked a lot of new longs in, thinking, oh, the war's over, we're going to go back to normality again. That's all I hear on the financial channels. If that doesn't turn out to be the case, and you start slipping back down again into the 4,400, 4,300 on S&P and so forth, they're going to realize, you know, what is this? That breakout was false. Because on a price chart, you took out some recent highs. Not the high high, but you took out some recent highs on the S&P, and no doubt caused a lot of shorts to cover and a lot of new longs to join in. So I think there's a lot of confusion here generated by that Russia-Ukraine thing. And people wrong on both sides of the equation.
Well, Michael, I heard one analyst explain that there are a lot of fund managers, hedge fund managers, maybe maybe mutual fund managers as well, that have taken a lot of have sold a lot of their equities and built their cash, but they can't be seen to hold cash at the end of the quarter, and so they're back in buying this week. That could have been a fundamental reason why the market is stronger this week, but you know, once March 31st is passed, you could look for some some selling. So I've been thinking maybe we're going to see some weakness. But I have to ask you, with this, of course, also, we're into a higher interest rate regime, an interest rate market, and you made a call, which I've been waiting for a long, long time. You know, many times I've asked you, you know, when are we going to have only one left safe haven, that being gold? And you're sort of hinting at it. Well, you said TLT is broken. The long bond is broken. It's broken down. Do you think this is a long-term event?
Yeah, I think it's a long-term event. There could be flash rallies in the T-bond market. Now, you've got to remember what maturity we're talking about. T-bond futures are 30-year, okay?
Yeah.
Most of the bonds that folks focus on are long-term bonds, meaning 10-year. The case of the U.S., that's called 10-year notes.
Yeah.
In the case of Japan, it's JGBs, Japanese government bonds. They're 10-year, or the bunds in Europe. Now, technically, the annual momentum trend of those markets has broken down, meaning price down, yields up. And you can even see it on some of the price charts, long-term price charts. I found an interesting event the other day. The JGB, while we're the hawkish over here, which won't last long, I don't think, but the JGB is totally dovish, and they said, we will spend unlimited, it was the word they used, amount of money to defend the yield curve and buy the 10-year JGBs.
Oh, my goodness.
We put out a report on JGBs about a week ago showing their annual momentum trend breakage. I'm curious today to see what happened after that JGB statement, very bold statement. It was lower in price than it was when we did the report, despite the fact that they declared they would spend unlimited amount of funds to support that market. I love it when governments become impotent, okay, because they created the distortion. When it comes unraveled and they can't stop it, they go into panic mode.
Yeah.
And effectively, the BOJ is already there. So.
Yeah, that's so the market's sniffing out inflation, perhaps, I guess, right?
Yeah, and you know, the vulnerability of these debt instruments that had been the alternative, like you said, another alternative for asset managers to park money in times of uncertainty. So over the last couple of years, it's been true. They bought T-bonds at the same time they bought gold. Now, that is no longer the case. You look at a T-bond chart and a gold chart, they're opposites. So they've divorced. Yeah. And now it's basically, I think, gold and silver markets will be at the fore again.
All right.
Another advantage of those markets. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, gold and silver have had a major sideways congestion.
Yes.
It really has been sideways if you look at the charts. That's not true with a lot of the hot commodities. Mm-hmm. A lot of these hot commodities like oil and so forth are vulnerable for corrective or congestive processes. But gold and silver have already undergone that.
Mm-hmm.
So they're fresh to go up again. They're not extended. So I think it's their time.
Okay, well, let me just real quickly, Michael, you put out something a few days back on Bitcoin, or maybe it was just even yesterday, I don't know. You're sort of suggesting if Bitcoin gets to a certain number by the end of this week, there may be some upside to it.
Yeah, it's crossed the intermediate trend. We went bullish 3 weeks ago. And then we crossed some numbers that we can call longer-term trend indicators. Intra-week, we've crossed them this week. I prefer to see the weekly close above those certain numbers, and we're above them right now, but it's only Tuesday. So, it looks like Bitcoin's trying to base and turn here. And I think this week's close may say something, but it's a little early in the week for that.
To
close over the key numbers as of Friday. So
I'm certainly watching to see what happens by the end of the week, Michael. Thank you very much for all you do. This is a good reason, folks, why you should consider subscribing to Michael's letter. You can make money, and I have in the past at times done very well with Michael's work. And so I want to thank you, Michael, for spending time with us again today and for your insights.
You,
they're very valuable. Very valuable. Thank you so much. Well, folks, we do have to go to break. Don't go away, but because Patrick Highsmith will be with us to give us an update on Timberline Resources. Wow, it looks like they've hit into some real good Carlin-style high-grade gold mineralization. I think this is a story you're going to want to keep your eyes on this summer as the company begins drilling aggressively in Nevada. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Patrick Highsmith.
Lion Wine Metals is focused on high-grade gold in Fiji, led by legendary Canadian financier Walter Barakoff. Lion One is permitted for production and drilling for discoveries in one of the most exciting high-grade gold projects in the prolific South Pacific Ring of Fire. Lion One trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol LIO and on the OTCQX under the symbol LOMLF. Go to our website at liononemetals.com for more information about Lion One Metals and high-grade gold in Fiji.
SK Mining Corp, trading under the symbol ESK on the TSX Venture and ESKYF on the OTCQX, is a mineral exploration company targeting precious metals, rich VMS deposits in the heart of British Columbia's Golden Triangle. SK Mining controls a prospective land package totaling 130,000 acres, which lies across a geologic trend that once hosted the prolific SK Creek Mine. With a world-renowned geological team, funding in place, and shareholders such as Eric Sprott, SK Mining is on the cusp of a world-class discovery. Go to skmining.com to subscribe for updates.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. I'm really pleased to have Patrick Highsmith with me once again. This time he is here to talk about Timberline Resources. He was with us in January to talk about this company. It is a company with a story, an involving exploration story. I think it's very exciting. It's the Eureka Project in Nevada. It's a Carlin-style target that is really starting to show some great results just recently with some assays, and Patrick will talk to us about that momentarily. Before I say hello to Patrick, I should tell you that that the stock trades in the United States under the symbol TLRS. TBR is the symbol in Canada, 139.7 million shares at around U.S. 29 cents, I believe, is the latest number I've seen. That gives it a market cap, a really small market cap, which I think is very exciting, given what I think this company might be onto, $40 million in U.S. money, something like that. Company does have a small resource, a lower grade surface resource, but clearly Timberline is on to something, it seems to me, much more exciting. So I'm really happy to say hello to Patrick. Thanks for joining me, Patrick.
Well, hello to you as well, Jay. It's great to be here. Thank you.
It's really good to have you here, especially looking at some of the exciting numbers that were published in February and a couple more in March of this year. Really exciting. We first talked to you, I think it was back in January. Well, maybe for the sake of those who aren't familiar, might not have heard your initial interview on this program, give our listeners just a sense of the project and what you're looking to do there.
Well, Jay, the Eureka Project is a large land position on the Battle Mountain Eureka Trend mm-hmm. in Nevada. We have neighbors who are making gold, McEwen Mining to the north, Caliber Mining to the southeast. We also have I-80 Gold as a neighbor in this active district. Eureka is a famous district, Jay, because it was one of the larger silver producers in the late 1800s, and that's how it got its name. And it's now about a 10 million ounce and growing Carlin-type district in which Timberline is the largest claim and tenement owner in the district. It's an exploration project to be sure, but we do have that sort of foundational resource that you mentioned, which was first reported in a technical report in Canada in 2013 with that half a million ounces in the measured and indicated category, mm-hmm. but at a comparatively low grade of 0.62 grams per ton. But of course, some of that is oxide. And as you say, it comes to the surface. So there's potential in that resource, but we've been exploring to the east of that, Jay, sort of adjacent to it, and we've been drilling much higher grades in a new discovery area we call the Water Well Zone.
I guess that's where those high grade numbers have come out from Water Well. February 24th, 22.9 meters grading 6.11 grams per ton gold. March 9th, 41.1 meters of a little over 5 grams of gold per ton. And then the latest one was March 24th, 44.2 meters, grading 4.1 grams of gold per ton. Are you really seeing sort of a Carlin-style mineralization with these intercepts?
Jay, at Eureka, we've confirmed over the years that this is a Carlin-type system. And in mm-hmm. fact, there are multiple prospects where we've drilled gold. And of course, the resources at a place called Lookout Mountain. We're mm-hmm. just east of that now. Across the valley, a kilometer and a half away, is another target called Oswego, where we've also identified Carlin-type gold. Now, that means we're going to see rocks like limestones, shales, dolomites. These are sedimentary rocks. And the mineralization will often be sort of typical of a Carlin-type mineralization is you can't see the gold. It's so-called no-see-em gold. Mm-hmm. But it's associated with things you can see, like arsenic minerals or pyrite. It does come to surface. And as it gets deeper down, very often we see a sulfide style of mineralization sort of beneath the oxide mineralization that the district was first noted for. So definitely Carlin-type mineralization. And these thicknesses and grades, Jay, we have seen some of these similar grade and thicknesses in the earlier days of the delineation of the Lookout resource back in 2005 and 2006. The company Staccato Gold, whom we acquired in 2010, had drilled some really good intercepts. When I was at Newmont Mining, we looked at that project back in those days, noted the good grades and thicknesses then, but then, just sort of got away from that high grade zone. And now we've identified a new higher grade zone, which is outside of the resource. This would be an addition mm-hmm. if we're successful in proving this up, Jay, mm-hmm. right next to the old resource. And as you pointed out, we've now had two core holes that have passed through thicknesses over 40 meters, mm-hmm. are continuously mineralized with higher grade pockets within them, mm-hmm. Such as, like you pointed out, one hole was over 12 meters at 9.18 grams per ton. Mm-hmm. We're super excited about that. And, of course, the best hole yet drilled is also the southernmost hole in the Water Well Zone. We announced this in early March. hole 212C, and within that 41-meter interval of 5 grams, we actually ripped into a zone that was 19.8 meters of 9.5 grams. So really good high-grade stuff, Jay, and it seems to be hanging together. Mm-hmm. That's really the best news, Jay, is we've drilled at the far north end. We hit a high-grade interval that we've mentioned already, and now at the far south end, over 400 meters away, we've hit this 40-meter interval of over 5 grams with higher grade within it. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, every time we've drilled this horizon, which is at the base of a unit called the Dunderberg Shale, mm-hmm. every time we hit it, there's gold there, Jay. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes it's not economic thickness, but these intervals are very likely to be economic grade and width. And really, the interval's wide open to the south for over a kilometer and a half, a lot of potential there. And on the north as well, we have this higher grade zone wide open to the north and northwest. So we're faced with the opportunity to both sort of fill in and sort of start to drill this shape out. You know, it now has a footprint. We can kind of predict it. But we also have the opportunity to do the exciting exploration around these high grade holes and see where it goes from here, you know, to the north and south and east and west. So So that's what happens in the early days of a discovery. We're looking to see its footprint, and then we'll fill in that footprint and grow it. That's the objective now.
So you'll be doing, I guess, step-out drilling if you want to, along the structure that you've identified so far?
Yes, exactly. It's complicated. I mean, these Carlin-type deposits are just shattered with faults and fractures, mm-hmm. and those faults are the plumbing, Jay, and that's the other aspect of this recent news release I'll mention in just a minute. But so picture these cracks in the Earth's crust that have been the plumbing for getting these fluids in here, mm-hmm. and when we hit high-grade intercepts, I mean, 19.8 meters of 9.5 grams, with assays up to 25 grams in there, you're definitely going to want to do step-outs around that pretty close to really nail down the high-grade. Okay, so that's one aspect of what we're going to do, and that means you might be drilling near a fault, and that'll just jumble things up, and we'll have to drill more holes to figure out exactly where it goes, But those are the signs of a robust system, right? You get lots of these faults in that plumbing. And so we'll eventually be chasing that to depth as well, because some of these faults can be so-called feeder zones or the channels in which the highest grade are likely to be found. And I guess that brings up the other aspect of this recent news release, Jay, which is that we had this huge geophysical anomaly just east of this resource. Mm-hmm. And on the one side of it, where we're working now, we have the water well zone and the Lookout resource before that. But on the other side of this IP anomaly, we have that showing called Oswego, where we've hit some surface gold and we're still waiting on assays from a few drill holes. So right in the middle was this geophysical anomaly that suggested the rocks were chargeable. They had electrical properties that might indicate the presence of pyrite or maybe graphite. Mm-hmm. And we needed to drill test that thing. And that's a real exploration hole. And we reported that hole, and it was hole number 206. And, you know, you read through it in the press release, and we describe a lot of geology, and we describe some low-grade gold and silver numbers over significant widths, though, Jay. So what we've now learned is that that IP anomaly appears to be a real feature that we can see in the rock. We've drilled down there. We hit an intrusive rock. Think of it as like a granite, a very fine-grained granite. It's been shattered with alteration. It's sort of bleached out. It kind of turned to clay in places. And there's lots of pyrite in it, Jay. And around the pyrite, we also found this low level of gold and silver. Mm-hmm. And with that much silver, we can say pretty categorically that this intrusive is an older type of mineralization that actually was responsible for making the Eureka District famous with all that silver, lead, zinc production. Mm-hmm. But there is gold there as well. And we believe that the same channel, the same plumbing that intrusive followed up into these rocks could also be followed by the later Carlin-type mineralization. Mm-hmm. And this is just an earmark, Jay, of these great Carlin-type districts in Nevada. They have multiple generations of mineralization. So here you have older lead, zinc, silver, may or may not be of economic significance, but the Carlin trend has older silver, lead, zinc mineralization as well, followed by the Carlin-type gold later. Mm-hmm. So does the Archimedes mine north of us that I-80 Gold is exploring. We know we have the older silver, lead, zinc overprinted by the younger Carlin-type. And quite frankly, that silver, lead, zinc mineralization may also have prepared the rock to make it even a better host rock for when the Carlin type stuff came later. So it's mostly a geological story. We put some pretty pictures in the news release, Jay, to try to explain it to people in three dimensions. We're super excited about it because we just think it opens up a lot more potential getting a little bit deeper. And in that area, we, like I said, we've got high grade just 300 meters away to the west in hole 220C. Mm-hmm. So you got high grade over there and kind of a feeder structure down and an IP geophysical anomaly that we now have validated to be something real that needs, guess what, more exploration.
So that that anomaly, that intrusion, I guess, it divides the Oswego from the Lookout Mountain, if I understand properly, may or may not have economic value, but will you be, I guess, focused mostly on the Carlin style, like the water well, that and the Oswego, those areas first and foremost, or you'll be putting some deep holes down into the intrusion?
Well, we're absolutely going to focus and step out on these known high-grade showings that need delineation and what have you. But, you know, our mutual friend Quentin Henney, boy, he can't wait to see some deep holes in that, that area, Jay. And we love that, of course. And in Nevada, of course, there are deep underground mines mining very high-grade material. That potential is always there. But really, if you look at it in one of our cross-sections there in the press release, the symmetry is kind of exciting. We've hatched in red some of the potential areas that we'll be drilling for gold around this thing. And that symmetry sort of says, well, there's a system here, and it's wide now. It's, you know, it's over a kilometer and a half wide. This anomaly is over 2 kilometers long. So in that huge volume, we could fit a lot of gold. And if there happens to be some high-grade silver, lead, zinc down there, well, fantastic. We'll drill that too. But yeah, it's about really how this system got here and what its shape is and where are the sweet spots within it, Jack.
How well-funded are you, and can you talk a little bit about your drill program going forward?
You know, there's been a great response to this news, Jay, and we're in a much stronger position with our share capital than we have been. It was interesting. Our drill program went into the fall and winter instead of the summer. So our news flow didn't really begin until February, as you said. So we had these sort of doldrums, and we're really happy to see the share prices moved up. The budget of last year's program and Steve Osterberg, our VP Exploration, his delivery of that was fantastic. We came in under budget. So our goal was to leave $1 million U.S. in the bank when we were done with all this work. And we've more than done that. And we also have some warrants that are in the money that are being exercised now. And so that means our treasury is fine for this interim period before we start drilling again. No need to finance immediately. And we've gotten the share price to a much better position to finance. But we are planning a robust program, Jay. And quite frankly, let's just say we're preparing multiple budgets for sort of multiple scenarios. But one of the first things we'll be doing is a little bit of core drilling to sort of confirm these high-grade intercepts compared to some previous reverse circulation drilling that we've done in the area, which returned lower grades.
Right.
So we're going to investigate that a little bit more. The core drilling seems to be yielding much better grades than the RC, and we want to confirm that a little bit and queue up a sizable program for the summer and into the fall, too. But probably that would require a financing, and of course, we don't spend money we don't have, so we're really happy to see the market embracing this news, and we probably do have some work ahead of us here to cash up before we drill a big program.
Yeah, I think it's important for people listening to this program to know that management has skin in the game. I think I saw, Patrick, something like 20% or so of the shares are held by management. Does that sound right?
Yeah, board and management together is a little over 20%, I believe. Crescat Capital is our next biggest shareholder. They're somewhere in the teens. They're a significant shareholder, maybe 13 or 15%, something like that. And very supportive shareholder as well. So, yeah, Timberline's been around for a long time, and they got financed through this downturn, and Bill Batlack, one of our directors, was a big supporter and financier of the company, and that's one way the board accumulated so many shares. So we've definitely got a skin in the game here and a team that's committed to realizing what we think will be a big discovery in the Eureka District.
Boy, it sure looks promising. I'm excited about it, I must say. It is, of course, a recommendation in my newsletter. I own shares personally. It is a sponsor to this show, and I'm really proud to have it as such. Anything else, Patrick, before we wrap it up today?
Well, I just want to say stay tuned. We've got one more round of drill results to come. That'll come in April. Mm-hmm. Boy, the labs are busy, as you know, Jay, and some of those didn't get in the lab till February. So we'll have assays in April on the Oswego zone, which we had a great press release about in December. So stay tuned to that and look forward to our plans. We expect to be very active in Eureka. And of course, what a great place. If you're going to find high grade gold, and even if it's sulfide mineralization like this, Jay, if you're going to find high grade gold, Nevada is a great place to do it.
Absolutely. The infrastructure is there. Patrick, I'm really excited. Thank you so much for being with us today and explaining this story, and we'll look forward to it, to more good drill results in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jay.
All right, folks, we do have to go to break now, but don't go away. Alistair McLeod will join me to talk about the danger the dollar may be facing in terms of its world reserve currency status. Very important to Americans, very important to all of us. So stick around and hear what Alistair has to say right after the break.
Timberline Resources is a mineral exploration and resource development company focused on gold discovery in the world-class mining jurisdiction of Nevada. The company's flagship Eureka project hosts a significant gold resource and drill-indicated upside potential at nearby higher-grade targets. Timberline Resources trades in Canada under the symbol TBR and on the OTCQB in the U.S. under the symbol TLRS. To learn more about this district-scale asset with exciting discovery potential, please visit www.timberlineresources.co.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm pleased to have Alistair McLeod with me once again. Alistair writes a very important and fundamentally sound financial commentary every week titled Gold Money Insights. It is posted every Thursday on the research page at goldmoney.com. His views are based largely on free market economics, but Alistair is certainly not a rigid ideologue. He is a free thinker who examines the world as it actually exists, not as Keynesian economists think it ought to exist. And as such, he is very much in tune with Austrian economic theory, which, in my view, most closely exhibits the economic actions of free human beings. And that is why I'm always pleased to have Alistair with me. He's here once again, and thank you so much for joining me, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
It is always good to have you. We just so many things to talk to you about. So let's get going. I have to ask you about the end of fiat hoving into view was the title of your March 10th missive. Can you define the word hoving as it's used in that title?
Yes, I suppose coming into view, as it were. I didn't realize, perhaps my vocabulary is a little old-fashioned, but anyway, I do apologize for that.
Well, I don't know if it's old-fashioned or not. It's just a British saying, I think, more. Probably not old-fashioned in Britain so much. It's just something I wasn't used to hearing, and so coming into view would be more like it, I guess. The end of fiat money coming into view, I guess, is what you meant. Yeah. In that article, you stated the following, and I quote once again, I think I read this quote last time we talked, Putin made a huge mistake invading Ukraine, but the West's reaction by seeking to isolate Russia and its commodity exports from the global marketplace is an even greater one. Now, 2.5 weeks or so passed since we last spoke. Do you still believe that, more or less?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think events have rather confirmed that view. And of course, the effect of this has been to drive up commodity prices. So what Russia has lost in terms of sales volume, they've made up on price. And they can afford to sell oil, for example, at a substantial discount to their friends. And the amount of oil and gas that they sell to Europe is actually a very large quantity in terms of money. And I really do think that this move to say, I mean, basically what Putin has done is he's invoked a force majeure clause, which I'm sure is in all the contracts, all the oil and gas contracts, change the currency in which he's paid. And he's gone taking it back to rubles, which basically means that, over the course of a year, a very large amount of rubles will have to be bought. I think we're looking at about 2.5 trillion euros. Rubles. Mm-hmm. Will have to be bought in order to pay for essential oil and essential natural gas. And that is, it's a very, very clever move. It is exactly what President Nixon and Kissinger did with the Saudis back in 1973, and it created the petrodollar. And it meant that everybody had to buy dollars in order to pay the Saudis and every other member of OPEC. Very smart move then, and it's the same playbook.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you could make the case that Russia, with its population, is a more legitimate country to own the petrodollar, a petrol currency, than the U.S., because the U.S. had to go around, well, we produced oil and gas at that time, but we really got the Saudis, the big oil producers, to back up. We told them, you know, we made the arrangement that they had to sell their oil in dollars, and of course, countries all around the world that had to be net importers of oil had to go out and buy dollars. So that is really what made the U.S. own the world's reserve currency after Nixon took us off the gold standard, right? And so do you think anybody's taking Putin up on this? Because the Germans come right out and said, no way. You got to honor your contract. We don't have any contracts that we have to give you. That we have to pay for it in your currency.
Well, I can understand that political reaction, but the reality is that every contract has a force majeure clause, and basically, what's happened is that the Western nations, including the buyers of this oil themselves, the EU, have turned round and changed the whole thing. So the Russians, as far as I can see, are perfectly entitled to respond by saying, right, we want payment in rubles. And if we don't get paid in rubles, no oil, no gas. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, that is the choice. And what it would mean is that the EU nations would then have to scramble to get what they can from other sources. And there is not a lot of sort of flexibility in the whole system. So that means that they would probably have to bid up oil and gas. Russia would end up exporting less, if you like, outside Russia, but they would still be exporting increased quantities in through China, India, and so on and so forth, who are prepared to take Russian oil and gas at a discount. I mean, so, you know, it's the Russians are just sort of sitting there saying, well, you know, you got the problem, mate. You created the problem. All right, we invaded the Ukraine. But, you know, basically, you've shot yourselves in the foot. And that actually is pretty well what the West has done.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would seem so. I mean, I'm sure the U.S. will try to do what it can to, I think it's trying to send some, you know, liquefied natural gas over there and all that sort of thing. But I don't imagine that we can come close. Of course, as we come into the summer, maybe it's not as important as during the winter, but air conditioning and things like that too, I suppose, in the more advanced countries anyway, will be important. Alistair, to what extent do you think this is a bigger deal in terms of supply chain disruptions than the COVID-19 thing or similar? Or what are your thoughts?
Well, yes, I mean, it is a disruption. But I mean, talking about supply chains, I think they're bigger disruptions in China. I mean, they've just shut down virtually the whole of Shanghai over COVID. China is still following this policy of just shutting everything down as soon as there's a hint of COVID. And that is just, that's not doing anyone any good at all. And the Chinese economy itself has pretty much stopped growing. And, that has been the engine, the production engine for the world. So I think that's probably more important in terms of supply chain than Russia, though there's no doubt about it that the Western sanctions are disrupting basic commodity supplies. I mean, particularly energy, also other commodities like fertilizer. We face, as a world, we're going to face a very difficult summer because, you know, the Ukraine region and also that part of Russia is the breadbasket of Europe. Mm-hmm. It's also a massive producer of fertilizer, which means that countries which would look to perhaps try and maintain their grain yields over the summer are going to find it extremely expensive to do so because of the lack of fertilizer. I mean, I really do worry about the potential for starvation, particularly in the third world. And with that, I mean, particularly in places like Africa. And again, China has cornered the grain market. I mean, you've got 20% of the world's population in China who have roughly 70% of the world's wheat reserves. I mean, sort of, you know, stocked up, wheat stocks. Rice stocks, similar. Maize stocks, similar. Soy, I think, is something like 30%. And this is leaving everybody else very, very short. I can tell you this summer is going to be one of hunger and possibly worse for an awful lot of people.
Mm. It's a very sobering thought. I would imagine with China's economy slowing down, the only thing they know to do is what every other sort of central bank does around the world, and that's just print money. The Chinese will do that. I mean, they can't have civil unrest. I mean, that's, they've got to try to avoid that, right? And Michael was just saying also that the Japanese central bank is saying that they're going to print whatever it takes, as much money as it needs, to try to keep their yield curve intact. I mean, it's just craziness everywhere. Biden's come out with a 5.3 or $5.8 trillion budget. I mean, it's just running amok. It's almost exponential. It's this nonsense.
Yes, it's completely out of control. I do agree. About China, which was your first point.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
China recognized the inflationary effects of the Fed's policy back in March 2020, when it reduced interest rates to zero and instigated $120 billion a month of QE. And it was really from that moment that China started stockpiling the commodities and raw materials and food, which she deemed necessary to protect her own people from these the inflationary effects. And consequently, prices in China are rising, they reckon, on sort of CPI terms, around about 1% per annum. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very different from the West. They've been quite sensible. Now, they do have a property crisis, and they're trying to deal with it by expanding credit. So they're trying to, if you like, sort of, you know, soften the landing, as it were. But you're not really seeing the inflationary policies that we see in the West. Your second point about the banking of Japan. The Bank of Japan has a huge problem, which is shared by other central banks, and that is it is now in negative equity. And what I mean by that is its liabilities exceed its assets. Now, the reason this has happened is because it has got an enormous amount of Japanese government bonds, corporate bonds, and also even equities on its balance sheet. And these are collapsing in value. I mean, particularly the bond portfolio is just really in an awful mess. And it cannot afford to see higher bond yields. And so it is desperately trying to put a cap on it. It's been trying to buy the 10-year JGB on a yield of 0.25%. It's still in negative interest rates. It cannot afford. I mean, it's just got completely caught. So we have a situation where the Japanese central bank is bust, and not only that, but the underlying big Japanese banks are leveraged on a basis of asset to balance sheet equity over 20 times. I mean, you know, rising yields in the bond markets are undermining the commercial banking network and the central bank itself, this is a major crisis. And this is why we're seeing the Japanese yen tanking. I mean, it's falling. It's just a John Rawls situation all over again, which I know we've talked about in the past.
Yes. Well, and the Japanese central bank isn't the only one. You point out as well, the Fed and the Bank of England also have negative rates. And you pointed that out, and rates have risen quite a bit. At least U.S. Treasury rates have risen a lot since then. So I would presume that we're more negative than we were when you first made that comment a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And the one that's really worrying, I mean, I can see how a central bank gets rescued. I mean, that's, you know, it's easy. I won't go into the details. It's actually relatively simple to happen. It just involves the government basically, borrowing money from the central bank on the one side and depositing it back on the other in the form of equity. So that's easy. That's easy. But it's damned embarrassing. I mean, you don't want to have to do this in the middle of a financial crisis. Yeah. So that's the first thing. The ECB is in a terrible situation. The ECB itself is in negative equity big time. It's got the same problem as the Japanese. We're on negative interest rates, and it cannot afford to raise interest rates because it is seeing the value of its enormous portfolio, which it's got on board, just collapsing. So it's trying to sit on the interest rate situation. On top of that, its shareholders, who would come to its rescue, are the national central banks. Mm-hmm. And guess what? They're all in negative equity as well. And you have a situation where the commercial banking network has got liabilities into Russia and Eastern Europe and goodness knows what. It's an absolute mess. And they're leveraged over 20 times on the basis of asset to equity. So you've got the commercial banks going bust. You've got the national central banks going bust. And you've got the ECB going bust. How do you resolve that one?
I don't know. I mean, that's who knows? I'm just wondering here, Alistair, we have a flattening of the yield curve here in the U.S. That's pretended recession in the past. It's almost perfect in its prediction of it. Might we see a collapsing or, say, a recessionary, if not depressionary, U.S. economy and maybe around the world, and so rates just plunge again?
I've been watching this commentary with great interest because, if you've got a situation where, let's say sort of price inflation rises at the end of the credit cycle and then you sort of, end up going into a recession and so on and so forth. Yes, the yield curve does forecast, if you like, the recession. And basically what happens is that you find that the short-term rates are higher than the long-term rates. Mm-hmm. The long-term rates are telling you that you're going into the recession. This is different. This is very, very different, because what is happening is that everybody is trying to adjust to a situation where we've got hugely negative yields the whole way along the yield curve, and those negative yields are getting worse. I mean, I know we've seen the 10-year yield rise to 2.5%.
Yeah.
You've got a situation where, CPI inflation is running at, 8%, something like that? Negative yields of over 5% at the moment,
yes.
And that's on official numbers. So this, I think what's happened is that the long end just hasn't actually caught up with events. And you're going to see a negative yield curve, fine, going for some considerable time, but the whole thing is going to shift. And I would not be surprised to see the 10-year yielding well over 5%, maybe within the next 3 months or so, and at the long end, not too far behind. So I think this is a fundamentally different situation from saying that, a negative yield curve is a pretty good indication of, a recession. Actually, what we've got now is I think we've got runaway price inflation, because we've had runaway monetary inflation.
Right. So will they try to outrun that by printing more and more, faster and faster, exponential rise in monetary, like the Japanese central bank is doing? Is this a sort of a runaway hyperinflationary event that we see staring at us?
I think it's quite likely. I mean, the Fed has got a choice on this one. And basically, I think their mandate is to keep the system going, which basically means they've got to rescue everything. And the only way you rescue everything is by trashing the currency. And this is what's happening in Japan at the moment. I think Japan is leading the way. We were talking about the end of fiat hoving into sight. The Japanese yen is leading the way. I thought it would be the ECB, but this is a race you don't want to win.
Race to the bottom.
Yeah, ECB. I think the euro is next, and then after that, I think that this is likely to push money into dollars, into some Swiss francs, whatever. Fleeing these two currencies. So you've got this brief situation, I think, which means a stronger dollar, stronger Swiss franc, even possibly a slightly stronger sterling. And then I think that the plagues that are hitting, the financial plagues that are hitting the yen and then the ECB, the euro, I think will begin to infect us all.
With just about a minute and a half or so left here, I know that the currency reset is something that Jim Rickards and a lot of other people have been talking about. You, in your last piece, really sort of are suggesting there's no real way to go from one fiat currency to another now, if I read you right, believing that we need to go towards, I don't know if you think it's inevitable, towards some sort of a stable monetary system based on silver and gold. And I'm just wondering, with Russia's move towards demanding payment of oil in petro or in rubles, if this might be the start of something like that?
Well, it could evolve into that. A lot of people have sort of been, gold bugs have been excited by the, the central bank will buy gold at 5,000 rubles a gram. But that's basically to ensure that the gold mining industry can continue to be financed. That's what that's about. It's not about you and me turning up in Moscow with our ruble notes and saying, please, want to cash it in for gold. No, it's in fact the other way around. But anyway, apart from anything else, it's not a gold standard. But there is no doubt in my mind that they are setting the pace, if you like, for the destruction of the Western fiat currency system. Mm-hmm. And we can't reset it. I mean, the governments can't reset it. It's got to be the people that do it. And I think what happens is that eventually governments have to accept that the only way they can stop their currencies going to zero is to turn them into credible gold substitutes. And that is the answer at the end of the day.
All right.
So there we are.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it go at that. We're out of time. Alistair, thank you so much for spending time with us again and sending along your insights to all of these very complex issues. And folks, go to read Alistair's missives every Thursday at goldmoney.com. Thank you, Alistair. All right. Well, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Tavi Costa and Kevin Smith of Crescat Capital will be with us, and Patrick Highsmith will be back to talk this time about Firefox Gold. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Firefox Gold is exploring in Finland in the midst of an exciting new gold rush. Firefox successfully drilled high-grade and visible gold in 2021 and is now active at four prospective projects with plans to drill continuously through the first half of 2022. The company's strong international leadership team, combined with its Finland-based exploration specialists, are driving the company to discovery, and the stage is set for Firefox to identify multiple new gold deposits. Firefox Gold trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol FFOX and on the OTCQB at FFOXF. Go to firefoxgold.com to subscribe for updates.